Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we have with us from outside of Sacramento, California, Jamie Wright. Welcome to the show, Jamie.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Do I need to introduce you as the world's worst missionary? Is that like how you're supposed to be referred to as, like Miss Worst Missionary?
That is usually how I'm introduced, which is super awkward.
Is it?
Because, yeah. Because people don't know. They're just like, oh, that they're usually like, well, that was rude of the person who introduced me. Like, oh, this is Jamie, the very worst missionary. And people are like, that was an awful thing to say.
That is a mean thing to say to someone, yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to go with N.T. Wright's foul-mouthed niece. That was going to be my other introduction.
Don't I wish. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
I actually got to talk to him like 3 weeks ago.
That's amazing.
And it was like he poured me a glass of water. And as soon as he left the room, like after the hour of talking, like I held the glass of water like it was like Eucharist or something. And it was pretty amazing. So, but truth be told, you're actually not his foul-mouthed niece.
I am correct? Not. There's no relation as far as I know.
Okay. We could start that rumor if you'd like.
I'm good.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm cool.
Can we talk about why we're just doing an audio? We're not actually doing a face-to-face conversation.
If we have to.
I think that is really funny.
Okay.
So I usually record these using Skype. And so I don't record the video because I don't think people really want to do, like, people don't want to see people talking, right?
Totally. Yeah.
Like,
agreed.
Do you ever Skype or FaceTime with normal people?
Mm-hmm.
Like, but you don't do that without scheduling it, right? You're not some kind of monster, are you?
No, yeah, no. Who makes phone calls or like pops into people's personal space like that? No.
I really feel like on your phone, there should be at least like 4 levels of security before you accidentally can FaceTime someone.
Oh, totally. Oh, absolutely. You should have to put in codes and answer one of those questions like a bank, like you have to do for your bank.
Yeah. Maybe like an ID test or something or something like that.
Retina scan.
Exactly. That's what I think you need.
Mm-hmm.
But I usually use the Skype ones, and we're not doing that. We're just doing a conversation right now with just the audio. And because you said I just got back from the gym, and so I really appreciate that we're good enough friends after knowing each other for 4 minutes now, that we don't even need to look at each other face to face, and we can just talk.
Yeah, it's like we just pick up where we left off last,
and we can complete each other's
sentences,
sandwiches,
absolutely,
sentences.
Oh man, I blew it. I'm so sorry.
It's all right. We'll change that and edit afterwards.
I didn't think this was going to be a face-to-face. I've done podcasts that are, and I've done podcasts that aren't. And I don't know why. I should have asked.
It's really no big deal.
Should I get dressed?
Can I tell you a really funny story?
Yeah.
I had like the one time I've kind of ventured outside of like the author, the pastor, Christian thinker type people. I had a former UFC champion, a guy named Rich Franklin, who had just done a TED talk about how to be a good loser. I thought, oh, that's a good subject. Let's talk about that. And so we do have a Skype with him, and his question is, hey, is this video? And of course, this guy's been on ESPN, and he's a regular guy all over TV. And I said, no, it's just an audio. And he's wearing like a hoodie with no shirt underneath because, he's a UFC fighter. You don't need to wear a shirt. And he goes,
right?
Good. And so he like unzips it. I'm like, awesome.
Right
now on.
We're comfortable.
Yeah. And so you and I are comfortable now. We can do this. Now you're living Northern California. Is Sacramento Northern or is like Middle California?
It's considered Northern California.
Okay. So you're Northern California. You've been back for how many years?
2.5 years.
How is life back in the States after doing mission work?
It's good. The States are awesome. We're so lucky to live here. I love it every day. Honestly, I really love my community and I loved living in Costa Rica. We were there for 5 years and it was certainly home for us, but it presented different challenges for me in particular. My family, they're like adapters. Like we get there, they're adapters. They're all great. They pick up Spanish and love life. And I guess I'm not, I always thought I was like a flexible person, but we got to Costa Rica and I was just like, oh my gosh, it amped my anxiety level just on a daily basis. I just was like anxiety level orange, like crazy.
Yeah.
So
I like my routine a whole lot and I'm terrified of leaving Texas ever. So I completely respect that. Is that kind of where the mantra or the nickname World Worst Missionary came from? Like that, like sense like, oh, I should be better at this because I'm a missionary?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. It was in our second year there. I just sort of imploded and felt like such a loser. Like here, my family was doing so great and people were working all around me. And I was just like, I didn't even want to leave my house. So I was like, oh, I don't think I'm doing this right. But then there's this kind of tongue in cheek, like I swear and drink and I mean, just do, I have all these non-missionary-ish behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so some people really do think that I'm a really bad missionary. Like I've literally had people say, you are the worst missionary.
Mm-hmm.
When
I was an intern after my sophomore year of college, I was working at this church in Atlanta and there's four interns in this youth ministry. And so the other guy intern had kind of like thought it'd be funny if he would just refer to us as the like worst interns ever. Mm-hmm. And so this is like 2000. And so I didn't steal this from you, just FYI. But so the whole summer was like, oh yeah, we're the worst interns ever. And at first, oh yeah, this is kind of funny. And, you know, I have a somewhat healthy self-esteem, I think. And by the end of the summer, I was like, maybe I am a crappy intern. Maybe I'm not good at this. Like it kind of wore on me. Did that ever happen to you as you've kind of carried this nickname around for a while?
No, I don't take it too seriously. Like it's mostly just kind of funny.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like it's typically not 100%, but a lot of times missionaries are very, there's a personality that goes with it and, they feel like chosen and special and righteous and, you know, and like set apart. And so I kind of like the idea of just being like, oh, we all kind of suck. And even if you move overseas and excel all your crap and move overseas to quote unquote serve God, like you can still suck. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's just funny. It's just funny.
How do other missionaries take, you know, you're joking about that?
I think they either completely identify and are like, oh my gosh, yes. Or they can't identify at all and are offended.
Is that kind of how, obviously you're a sarcastic person. And I think you post something on Facebook about, you know, how you made a sarcastic joke to a pregnant girl, which there's no way in heaven I would make a joke to a pregnant woman, but I'm a man, so I can't really do that anyway. But it didn't go over well. And I've told many jokes that did not go over well. And like on a podcast, you can kind of edit those out. But like in real life, you just can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of the response? It seems like you would have people who really identify with your ability to take what you do seriously, but not take yourself seriously. And others who just, who can't even get there.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like just two ends of the spectrum, people who get it or they don't get it.
What do you think separates the people who do and don't?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think it's personality, history, mm-hmm. God. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but people there seems to be a very defined line between like there's people that get it and enjoy it and people who don't.
It seems like the people who would get that are the people who are in on the joke. Like they understand, mm-hmm. oh yeah, I really do have like deficiencies in who I am. And you kind of speak into that. And it seems as like, I understand like your blogging presence, which I don't pretend to understand blogging a whole lot, but from my perspective, it seems that, you know, your audience is people and your readership is people who gravitate towards your honesty and your ruthless ability to just like pull back the layers and say, this is who I am. And mm-hmm. that's really appealing to other people, to them. But other people, I would assume it like offends them and steps on their toes because maybe it makes them go places they're not comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. And it can be, I mean, yeah, I think it's, honesty can be off-putting, especially if you're not particularly used to living in that bubble, like in that, if you don't live in that realm yourself, like if you are very much about like, this is my persona, this is what I show people, this is, you know, if you have like this facade that you're trying really hard to keep up, if you're trying to be be the soccer mom or be the good Christian or be whatever, I think it can be really intimidating for people who see when you don't care about any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Like when you're just like, oh, this doesn't matter to me.
Do you think Christianity, not just being a pastor or a missionary, but do you think Christianity in general encourages people to not live in that realm of honesty?
Oh, absolutely. I think Christianity has just done a horrendous job of teaching people how to live in freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Christianity is the church is such a pro at building walls and building facades and saying, this is how we behave and this is how it looks to be a Christian, and behaving one way in public and not absolutely opposite way at home or, you know, in private. And I mean, I think we just see that all the time in the mission field. There'd be missionaries who, you know, would like hide their wine bottles when supporters were coming to visit, you know, like, oh, yeah, we love them, they're great, they support us, but we don't want them to know that we drink because, oh my gosh, they would stop supporting us. Or, you know, like,
but there's like a real, you know, economical issue there. I mean, cause mm-hmm. you need money. I mean, you have to have people writing you checks to keep you, you mm-hmm. know, paying the bills and being able to buy your, whatever you buy in Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that pressure of, well, maybe I'm kind of oversharing and I need to make sure that, you know, my husband and our three kids continue to get those checks written to us?
Yeah. Isn't that gross? It feels gross talking about it, but there was definitely an element of like, we have to protect our job and our family and, you know, but I try to be careful. I know people are like, oh, you just say anything. And I'm like, no. If you knew what I filtered, you would just be like, oh my gosh. And so I think my husband is like, I think he sees that I hold back you know, I've never written anything that he's been like, oh my gosh, can't say that.
I've got a guy named Richard Beck, who's got a blog. It's popular as well. Experimentaltheology.blogspot.com is his site. And he says he's got this like list of posts that are like, please publish after my death, because I don't want to post these now, but I've written them and I can't get them out there. Do you have a list of topics that maybe you would write about, or maybe you've already written that post-mortem you would post them, but until then you don't want to share them?
No. There's other people I'm waiting to die so I can share stuff about them. But like, no, not myself. Like I really just don't have any secrets. It's just, life is just not that big of a deal. You know, like I really feel like we're all just kind of doing our thing and trying to get through it and to have secrets or to have, you know, I don't know, try and be something you're not is just not.
Well, then what makes you the person who can write those things? I mean, we're all struggling. We're all trying to do the best we can to get through life, but some of us don't feel like we can let the guard down. What is there something about you? Maybe something traumatic happened when you were a child. I don't know, were you bitten by a spider and you became like a super honest hero or something? What happened? What allows you to do that and others can't?
I don't know. You know, honestly, part of it is that I really do. The healthy part of it is that I understand my value in God, right? I understand where my value lies, and it does not lie in your hands or in the public's hands or in any, you know, like my value lies in God. And I'm very comfortable with that. The unhealthy part of it is that there is like a self-loathing kind of like, you know, shit, like, I don't even know the word for it, but like, I just am like, oh, I don't care because, you know, yeah, I suck or whatever. Like, it's just not that, I don't know. But really what it comes down to is I just don't care what other people think about me. I mean, there are certain people that whose input I value.
Yeah.
And who are very good about letting me know when I'm off base. And I so appreciate that. But I just, you know, the internet or whatever, like, I just don't care. Like, no. It's what a waste to be like, oh no, that internet doesn't like me, you know?
Okay. Well, obviously there are people that you do care, they're opinion about mm-hmm. your close friends, your husband, mm-hmm. me, of course.
Oh, yes.
And so, but others you just don't care about. Now, as you were describing, like you really get your value in God, I'm sure some of us are going, I would really like to get to that place. Do you have any like suggestions of people if like they're trying to get there, things that might help them on their journey as they try to get closer to that?
Honestly, the advice would be to practice honesty, like practice honesty. I know that it can be hard for people at first. I know that it can be hard, but what happens is when you just kind of put your stuff out there, what you find is less shame on you or less whatever and more, oh, me too.
Yeah.
Like it's a community building kind of thing.
I know you had a friend post some stuff with Brené Brown quotes in it not too long ago, so I'm assuming you have some familiarity with her work, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so she's got this great thing about when we see vulnerability in other people, we see it as strength. But when we see it in ourselves, it comes across as weakness.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think we can kind of like overcome that? Obviously, practicing honesty, I'm assuming you're meaning like in, do you think in like small ways with people you trust first, and then you can get to a bigger way? Or what are ways that we can change our perspective on that?
I definitely think in small ways at home, you know, really owning your stuff and, you know, being honest with the people who are closest to you about who you are and what you're experiencing in life. And, I think that's important. I think acknowledging our brokenness, like acknowledging the stuff in us that really, that we are afraid of people to see, you know, we are afraid that, oh no, someone might see that I'm lazy or whatever. Like I think acknowledging that and really addressing it in your life, mm-hmm. like just going, this is a flaw that is hurting my character. And I need to really like lean into that and work on it. I think that's, I just think there's a lot of value in that.
No. Yeah. Well, obviously you've got 3 kids, you've got a husband. And so when you're sharing your story, you're in a lot of ways also sharing things that are very connected to their story. And I was mm-hmm. talking to Donald Miller like 2 weeks ago, and he's got a new book, and it's writing about like his engagement and his marriage to his new wife. And he is super vulnerable in his newest book, especially at the very beginning. He talks about some really hard things that not a lot of people, like besides you, of course, would be willing to talk about. And, you know, one of my questions for him was, are you going to be able to continue to write this honestly when you have someone else who's partnered with you and you're not just sharing your junk, but you're sharing the junk that's in the middle of your marriage? And I see you as someone who does have a husband. You do have kids. And so when you're really honest about your struggles, you're also being honest about kind of everyone's struggles in your family. How do you draw that line of, I'm going to be honest about myself, but without like infringing upon the privacy of the rest of my family?
Well, first of all, if I write or post anything online about my family, they know ahead of time. Like mm-hmm. I would never just be like, I don't know. I would never post something without my kids' knowledge. They trust me. I mean, no, my family doesn't read my blog. My husband does not read it. He doesn't.
Seriously?
I mean, oh yeah.
He doesn't.
He's like, people ask him all the time, oh, did you read your wife's blog? And he's like, no, I live it. I'm good.
My wife says the same thing. She does not listen to the podcast. People's exact same thing. She's, I listen to him talk every day. I don't need mm-hmm. to hear him on. Yeah. Yeah. So your husband doesn't read it.
Yeah, no, he's just like, no, thanks. I'm good.
That's awesome.
Which is fine. But he also trusts me to tell an honest story and to not, and to, you know,
what about kids?
Overset my boundaries. The kid, they don't care.
Okay. You wrote a story and I actually emailed, or I talked to one of my friends, and she's a big fan of yours. I said, you know, what should I talk to Jamie about? Obviously you like her writing. And she sent me a link to a post you did on sex and which you giggled. I'm glad we're not doing a video face to face one right mm-hmm. now, cause I would probably be giggling too. But, there's a lot of honesty and confession and, obviously you're very upfront and honest about your story and your past. And you've got a son, he's like in his 20s now, your oldest, right?
My oldest will be 21 on Sunday.
Oh my goodness, that's crazy. Yeah, and your youngest is a teenager too, right?
Yeah, 14.
14, I guess 21's not a teenager, but you know. So they're old, I'm assuming they're old enough to read. They mm-hmm. they mm-hmm. know, and so they're seeing their mom talk about her sexual history online.
Mm-hmm.
Does it ever just like gross them out, or do they go, Mom, come on, seriously, why do you have to talk about that?
They care. I mean, they've never said anything about it. Some of their friends read and they're like, oh my God, my friends read your blog.
Yeah.
But you know, we are an open family. We have conversations with our kids. They're just very blunt and funny and whatever. Our kids are super funny and clever. And,
yeah.
You know, we do have a little bit of like a shock jock sense of humor in our family. So mm-hmm. everybody's kind of like pushing, like constantly like pushing the line of appropriateness, yeah. including my kids.
Yeah.
So, you know, I,
so they haven't heard this at the dinner table. I mean, they have heard at the dinner table if they're going to see it online. So this isn't something new to them.
Oh yeah. No, it's all, I mean, okay. I don't know if I should tell this story.
See, you do have a filter. There it is. Turn it off though. Don't listen to that right now. Just no one's listening. Just you and me talking.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you a question. You can edit this out. can I say the word vagina like 15 times?
Well, I don't typically use that word, but Nadia Bolz Weber's been on the show, and so you're probably not going to say anything that she hasn't said.
Okay, well, you don't have to say it. So
I'm not. I've got three daughters, but I'm not going to say that word. No.
Okay. You might want to get comfortable with that word.
I just use euphemisms instead.
That works too.
Okay.
Well, I couldn't use a euphemism in this instance. So when my kids were younger, and my husband as well, they would do this thing where they would stand at the refrigerator or stand in the middle of a room, whatever. But usually I say the refrigerator. They would stand at the refrigerator and they would call up to me upstairs, "Mom, where's the ketchup?"
I'm terrified right now where this story is going.
Well, whatever. Terrified. Where are the eggs? Mom, where's the milk? Whatever it is. Mom, where's my underwear?
Oh, no.
And they could never apparently move things, or they just couldn't find it. But I could be standing in my bedroom and just say, it's, you know, on the door and the second shelf.
My wife does that to me. Yeah.
No, and I finally sat them down. I said, "Look, there's only really one difference between you and me, and it's that I have a vagina. So either I am just capable of knowing all of these things and finding things magically because I have a vagina, or you're not looking hard enough. Like, it's those are the two reasons that you can't find things.
They're really good options too. Either one could be the answer.
Right. And so I finally just said, if you continue to scream at me, you know, when I'm in the bathroom because you can't find a pair of socks, I will consult my vagina and you will hear about it." Like, so they would say, "Mom, where's the ketchup?" And I'd say, "I don't know. Let me ask my vagina." Hmm. And it worked great at first. They were horrified. They were just like, "Oh my gosh, my mother is so embarrassing. She's so horrible. I can't believe she's saying that."
I would be, yeah.
And then it completely backfired because it made them very comfortable.
Oh no.
And now they, you know, I can't shock them at all. I can't. They say things that are just like, "Oh my gosh."
Yeah.
So, yeah. So
well, note to self, I'm not coming over to the Wright's house for dinner anytime soon.
Right.
Cause I'm going to be scared.
I know. Now I feel like that was a really gross story, but, anyway,
you know,
the point was that we've just always been kind of this like blunt, funny, whatever family. And so our kids aren't, there's not much we can do at this point to just bother them.
Yeah. So they're okay with that. One of the things you're also very honest about is you talk about depression and you talk about how you struggle with that. It seems like that's a subject that it's kind of like taboo to talk about in some religious circles. Do you agree?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I think, I think parts of the church have made it a spiritual issue.
Really?
There's a lot of an attitude of like, well, if you're depressed, you just need to pray it away, or you're not right with Jesus, or your sin is, you know, overwhelmed. You're overwhelmed by sin. I went to a conference once where this older lady was talking about her son's struggle with depression, and I'm sitting in a row of chairs with about six other women who I know are on antidepressants. And this woman said, referring to her son's depression, that she was just so upset that he was on medication and couldn't believe that that was the route he took. Mm. And that the reason he was depressed was because of his sin life. And she quoted some Old Testament verse and said that he was like a dog returning to his own vomit, and that was the depression, sin and depression in his life. And I was just like, seriously, I was like, "Okay, girls, hold me back. I'm taking off my earrings. I'm going to just jump over these chairs and strangle the 60-year-old because she's so wrong." Like, this is just such a dangerous, dangerous message to send to people.
Why is it so dangerous to send that message out?
Because it makes them ashamed to get help.
Yeah.
I mean, to say, you know, this is your personal problem, work it out, that's not healthy. You know, and I think there are lots of ways to deal with depression. I don't think that everybody needs medication necessarily, you know, but to just discount it completely and say you're depressed because you love your sin and you're like a dog returning to its own vomit is, you know, that's just a hateful thing to say. It's hurtful and mean and dangerous.
Okay, so if that's a hurtful, hateful thing to say, what is the right thing for us to say to people who are struggling with depression or mental health issues?
How about, "I love you. How can I help you?"
Yeah.
You know, how about, what can I do to help you make a doctor's appointment? Because when you're super in it, the just making an appointment to see a doctor or a counselor is so overwhelming.
Hmm.
So overwhelming.
Well, why is it so overwhelming? It seems like it's just, you know, you make a phone call and you're there. It seems like it's easy for people who don't struggle with depression and they can't understand. Why is it so hard?
I don't know. Because I've never been the person that doesn't have depression. Yeah. Like I've never been that like high functioning, oh, I just do things that I need to do right away, like ever. And so, you know, but it's just paralyzing sometimes.
I have a friend who's been on medication for depression, and he says that it's like a fog rolling in. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I spent a summer in San Francisco, and so obviously you live in Sacramento. I'm assuming fog happens in Sacramento as mm-hmm. well. But you know, when I lived in San Francisco for a summer, it just rolls in, and it's like this overwhelming presence, and it's there, and you can't see as much, and it's there and it doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
You think that's a fair comparison for obviously it's his experience,
analogy.
Not yours, but yeah.
No, I think that's great, and I think it just lingers, and you're just, you know, it's hard to. It's really hard to get out of it, honestly. So I think if you have someone in your life that is struggling with depression, just to be able to say, I don't understand this,
yeah.
but I can see that you need help, yeah. or I can see that, you know, you're suffering or whatever, is pretty huge for the person.
So just being able to say something like that is enough, because there's some of us who would think, well, I need to do something more than just say, I'm sorry you feel this way, and I want to listen to you. Like, we would want to, hey, come, let me drag you out of the house and make you get out of your sweatpants and put on some grown-up clothes and, you know, go to the library. Like, that's what some of us would want to do to quote-unquote fix it. But that mm-hmm. doesn't work, does it?
You know, it depends on the person. I think it can help. Like, I think it can help. I think saying to your friend who's struggling, hey, can we just take a walk on Monday mornings? Like, because I enjoy your company, not because I want to drag you out of bed, but because you're my friend and I like you. Like, mm-hmm. You know, I think that can be super helpful.
Yeah.
But it's different for everybody, and I don't think there's any real, like, here's the prescription for fixing this. Mm. I think it's super individual and, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think some of the ways that we, kind of overemphasize just like how great we are can in some ways make it more discouraging and more overwhelming for someone who has depression? Like, if you have someone who's always quoting, you know, the nice thing their husband says to them, and then hashtag blessed after everything. You have a bit about blessed, don't you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hate that word.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll come back to that. Okay. But do you think sometimes the way that we're always putting on this facade about how great things are, and obviously this is the evil of social media, is it just perpetuates that. Do you think that is also something that's a deterrent for like mental health for some people who struggle with depression?
I don't know. I mean, I think people who struggle with depression are going to make those comparisons. Some, you know, are going to make those comparisons anyway to just whoever's around them. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think it's in general. I think it's a terribly unhealthy thing. Mm-hmm. You know, to create these facades. And I met someone last night who was like, "I read your blog," and I was like, "Oh my gosh, this is." It's always super embarrassing. I'm like, I don't know what to say. I'm sorry. I'm so awkward. And,
hold on. Why would you say you're sorry?
It's, I don't know. It just is like weird. But she was like, yeah. So she was like, I thought it was you. So I pulled up your Facebook page and I was like, I think that's her. And I was like, yeah, I post great pictures online. Like,
Yeah.
Every time I meet someone, I can just see the wheels turning in their head. Like, Instagram is good to her. You know, they're just like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, and so we all do it. I don't think it's particularly healthy, but I also don't think it's particularly abnormal, right?
Yeah.
To just be like, well, this is what I'm gonna put online. It's going to make me look better than I actually look in real life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a reason Instagram has like 47 million filters you can put on pictures. I mean, that's why God created Instagram.
Right. Was to make us beautiful.
Yeah. Okay.
Because that's what God values.
And hashtag we're blessed.
Blessed.
Okay. So let's talk about your rant about blessed. You hate the word blessed. You had a blog post about it, and it was, when did it come out? It was a while ago, wasn't it?
Yeah. I don't remember, but yeah, it's been
a while. And so you don't hate the word blessed. You hate the word that it has evolved into becoming, how it has become this mm-hmm. trite platitude that really doesn't express mm-hmm. what Jesus meant when he talks about it, like, say, in the Sermon on the Mount, mm-hmm. the Beatitudes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So every time you see someone do that, do you see it on social media still, where people are continuing to write?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a like an urging inside of you to link to your own blog post? Say, hey, check this out. You're an idiot.
No. I wouldn't do that, but it does. I mean, I do find it like irksome and annoying. I see a lot more like sarcastic use of hashtag blessed lately, which is cool.
Yeah.
But we've perverted that word so badly that I wish we could just banish it from English, like never use it again.
Okay, say someone is not informed and they didn't read your blog post. Mm-hmm. How have we perverted the word blessed?
You know, we've turned blessed into if something good happens to us, or if something that we wanted arrives on our doorstep, or if we get a raise, or if we have a healthy baby, or if we get a new car or whatever, we call ourselves blessed. But God's blessing is his presence, right? Mm-hmm. Like God's blessing is that he's with us, not that he gives us shit like to have in our house or like, and so when we use this hashtag blessed or whatever, when we use the word blessed to thank God for our financial gain or all the wonderful, great, awesome, happy, you know, white middle-class people, things that happen to us, it sends a message to everyone else.
What is
it? It says, if your baby wasn't born healthy, you're not blessed. Mm-hmm. But God is with that person and God is with that baby. They're blessed, right? Like we need to take that word back so that people understand that blessing does not mean that it's not, I'm blessed because good things are happening, but I'm blessed because all things are happening and God is with me.
Yeah. Obviously the Sermon on the Mount, it's the peacemakers. It's the people who mourn. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the people Jesus are saying, these are the blessed ones, the ones who are struggling for righteousness. And that's not really how we use it. But to be fair to the people who are using that word that way, it seems like we want a word to express gratitude and we mm-hmm. want to kind of point this back to the man upstairs and say, this is not from me, but it's from God. And so I'm really excited about my new Camaro. And so I want to say I'm blessed. Like, isn't there a way to do that without, I don't know, adulterating, you know, the word blessed?
Sure. If God gives you a Camaro, you're being punished. you're not blessed. Like that's,
what do you have against Camaros?
I don't know. It just seems so, I don't know.
If it's an automatic, you're obviously being cursed because it needs to be a standard, whatever kind of sports car you get. You can write that down. But okay, what is a way that we can express gratitude for material?
There is a word that we use to express gratitude and it's grateful.
Okay.
Like we say, I have gratitude. I'm feeling grateful.
But we want to God it up a little bit, you know, like blessed is like a gaudier, churchier version of grateful, isn't it? To some people.
Yeah, totally. It's like the it's a Jesus-y platitude. Like, oh, God gave me a Camaro. Really? Mm-hmm. Did God give you a Camaro? Or are you just living your life and God is present? And is God happy is God happy when happy things happen to us? Like, does it please him? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm sure that it pleases God to see his creation feel joy and feel fulfilled and work hard and earn things and, you know, work for their success. Like, I feel confident that that brings God pleasure.
Yeah.
And that he delights in that. But does that mean that he is like a cosmic puppeteer, like making these things happen in our lives? And so we should thank him mm-hmm. Like specifically for the Camaro? I don't know. I don't know about that. Like that makes me uncomfortable.
No.
Because if God is like zap giving you a Camaro, then what's happening to children in the Sudan?
Yeah.
Like what? That does not make sense to me.
No. There's the old line, if it's not good news everywhere, it's not good news. If it's not good news for everyone, then it's not really good news.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Side note, I wrote down the phrase Jesus-y platitude, which mm-hmm. seems like a great book title to me. So if you want to hold on to that, you did come up with it, so I'm not going to steal it from you. Because I do like the phrase Jesus-y platitude.
I'm never going to write that book. You can have it. It's fine. It's fine.
Okay. Obviously, missionary in Costa Rica, came back to the States. Your husband, isn't he a missions pastor now?
Yeah.
Okay. And you have kind of like this rant against short-term mission trips, don't you?
I, I do. I have several.
You have a couple rants. And so, like the basic rant, you know, white people spending a lot of money to go to be around people of color who are poor. How much are we really accomplishing? Is this like really the best use of funds? Is that a fair way to?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw on your blog that your church is sending like 7 people to some underprivileged area, and you're supporting it. Did I see that somewhere?
I don't know.
Maybe I made that up.
Oh, Cambodia. Yes.
Okay. So
yes, I do know what you're talking about. Sorry.
It's all right.
Like I don't even know the things that I write and put on the internet. I don't know.
Your uncle Tom Wright. I quoted something from his book to him 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he says, that sounds like something I would say. I don't know if I actually wrote it or not. So I guess it just runs in the family.
Yes. Yes. My uncle, Mr. Wright.
Yeah.
I think that there can be, we can do short-term teams internationally, locally, whatever, regionally. I think it can be done well. I don't think that we do it well very often.
Really? Why is that?
Well, the first fatal flaw is that we take volunteers. We say, oh, we're going to go to, Southeast Asia, and anybody who wants to go can go.
Really? Okay. So, but that seems like what you want to do. Like you volunteer anyone at church who's willing to serve and they're willing to take vacation. What's wrong with volunteers?
Well, they're ill-equipped or, not a good fit or high maintenance, or, I mean, there's just a million reasons why we should not just be taking every, 8-year-old boy and 79-year-old granny to Cambodia.
Okay.
Just to go for the sake of going to Cambodia to, hold babies or whatever it is. Like we have to kind of weigh our actions and say, well, what are we hoping to accomplish and how long do we want it to last? And, mm-hmm. What are we saying to the people that we're visiting? I mean, there's just so much more to it than I volunteer, as tribute, put me on the plane.
Okay. So who should go? Who are the people who are qualified and really should be the ones doing this kind of work?
Well, when you say this kind of work, what does that even mean?
I was using that pronoun referring to the antecedent of like short-term missions.
Right. So I don't think that we should just call it short-term missions.
Okay.
If there's a job to be done, then we should look at that job and then find the person who can do it well.
Okay.
And if that person is a local person and we can support them, then we should do that. If we have something to offer as in terms of like training or guidance or expertise, then we should send that person. Hmm. But just to say, we're going to send families to build houses in Mexico, build shacks in Mexico. When you look at that whole picture, when you have an 8-year-old girl swinging a hammer on a 35-year-old man's house, you've emasculated him. Like he's going to hide. He will not be present. He will not feel blessed. Right.
I see what you did there.
Yes. Yeah. It creates problems.
Yeah.
Like big, huge problems that we need to address. So, I do think we can do it well. I think that when we really focus, I can say, this is what we hope to accomplish. Who is best to do this? And when you look at the Bible, Jesus chose. He chose. Mm-hmm. That's our example. He chose the disciples. He chose who he sent out. The apostles, they chose. Like, that's our example of... and that's our role as a church. Our role as a church as leaders is to be able to say, I see this in you, to sit down with someone and say, I see this quality in you and this is where I think you fit. And I would like to equip you and help you do that.
Yeah.
So it's a lot more work.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely is a whole lot of work, but that mental image of, I'm 33, imagining some 8-year-old girl coming to build a house for me that I couldn't build for my, 6-year-old daughter, my 3-year-old daughter, my 1-year-old daughter, like that would be deeply emasculating. It would do a lot of damage to my psyche. And I mean, we typically don't think through that. Or at least I don't think through that because as a pastor, I think, well, we want to send money and we want to support something. And so there's no better way to build morale than by our people going there, having a hands-on experience and seeing it. But that's really through the eyes of what's best for my people and my church, not what's best for them. And maybe the bigger picture of like all humanity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, I don't even think it is what's best for you and your church. Like, I think building these mountaintop high moments, like putting someone on a plane and so that they can go look at poor people and feel like, oh, I'm so lucky because I have all this stuff or whatever. I don't think that's healthy. I don't think that's a really good thing to be reinforcing in our people.
Yeah. Can I be real honest? Since your whole thing is about honesty.
Yeah. It's your podcast.
You know, I appreciate you saying that. It is my podcast. I have a very tough time not being judgmental of people whose profile picture is them, if they're a white person, with a poor kid from like a third world country.
Mm-hmm.
I have a real tough time not judging them going, what are you trying to communicate there, man? Seriously, mm-hmm. What's going on? Am I allowed to feel guilty about that? Or should I just think I'm right?
I don't know that you should feel guilty or right, but because I'm sure there are some of those photos are very good and altruistic and, mm-hmm. But I think most of them are pretty gross and self-serving and you know, I don't think it's just very unhealthy.
Yeah. What I really hear you saying though is we need to think like big picture, what's really best for everyone involved, not just, you know, what mm-hmm. helps the church get a big Mission Sunday fundraiser. Right.
Yep.
And
what I
hear in your statement is someone who's actually like been in a situation where people probably went to Costa Rica for short-term mission trips if they wanted to, and mm-hmm. you probably saw like the long-term ramifications of what happens in that community and for those people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And
did
you have this attitude about quote-unquote short-term missions before you were a missionary down in Costa Rica?
I didn't know anything about missions before I became a missionary. Now that speaks volumes, right? Like someone put me on a plane and sent me to live in another country as a missionary. I don't even know that I'd ever even met, like, I'd probably met three missionaries in my life. I didn't even know what one was until I was an adult.
Wait, so how did you end up on that plane?
That's a long story for another podcast, but it's a very long story, but you know, so I got down there thinking like, this is awesome. I'm going to do great things. God is going to use me and, you know, all this stuff. And then, you know, I'm a bit of a realist. And so getting down there and meeting other missionaries was a huge eye opener. And just seeing the level of like social inability and, it was just so broken. There was so much brokenness and so many missionaries doing nothing or doing things that were, in my opinion, obviously harmful to the emotional and spiritual state of the people that they were trying to serve, making weird economic decisions, just really a lot of just weirdness.
Mm-hmm.
And so really it was 5 years of us just being like, oh my God, what are we doing?
Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to ask you the whole story, but just one question.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't end up on a plane in like a Liam Nelson's like daughter in Taken. That's not how you ended up as a missionary, right? It wasn't like someone, okay. It was not Taken, right?
I was not forced.
Okay.
Yeah,
good.
Not kidnapped into it.
Okay. That's it. I'm not going to press you anymore about that. life after missions. Is it weird being back in the States and like having the same sense of, you know, making a difference or like the sense of, you know, we really have a purpose and we really have a community. I know there's been like some issues for missionary friends of mine who come back to the States and then they get plugged into a church and they never really feel like they actually are plugged in. Do you ever have any of that issue or did you at first?
Not really.
No.
I mean, I just love living here. It's just so easy. And no, I would say that the biggest thing for me coming back and just, kind of having a new global perspective has been in just everyday living, like the decisions that I make to like how I spend my money, how I treat the planet. I mean, I'm not a hippie at all, like at all, but just much more aware of the decisions that I make and how they affect the rest of God's creation, like the rest of the people that he loves. And really understanding that I'm one person, but I do matter and yeah. I do make a difference. And so, you know, I feel a lot more burdened coming
really?
Back and living in the suburbs and just being like, does my life reflect, my love for Jesus and my respect for God's creation.
tell me more about that feeling of being burdened. Like, what does that mean?
You know, I don't know. It just makes me, I feel more, responsible for the people around me, like for their health and well-being, for their longevity and not just necessarily around, like directly around me, but like the people who make my clothes in Bangladesh. Yeah. Like I have a responsibility to make decisions that reflect my love for them. And so that I feel a burden to buy clothes that are, you know what I mean? Like that respect that.
Okay. So like besides the clothes you purchased, what decisions do you make now after having been in Costa Rica for years that you wouldn't have made before you went to Costa Rica? What decision are you making differently now?
I mean, I don't know. That's a hard question.
Well, okay. So clothes, you're picking different clothes.
Yeah.
Are you thinking about them maybe?
Yeah. I mean, that kind of stuff, but even like, just like taking care of the planet, recycling and, really just every aspect, understanding that every aspect of my life, reflects my worship of God, right? Like every aspect, there's nothing I can separate from how I live, and how I love God. Like it all has to mesh.
Good. Well, Jamie, it has been a lot of fun talking with you. And one of my goals for this interview was to never mention the blog post you did about ripping your jeans. And we didn't talk about that. And so I'm really happy. So congratulations to me for not bringing that up, because I would rather die than talk about that.
I know. I'm so glad I filled that space with the story about my kids looking for a ketchup bottle. Yay.
Exactly. Yes.
Well done.
Gosh. Yes.
Now we got that out.
Man, we might leave it in. Who knows?
Oh, God.
Jamie, it's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Yeah, this is great.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.